The tape that you are about to hear has been declassified by disability and disadvantage analysts at CFMU Radio. This taped record of conversation had never been heard before being released to you, the CFMU listener. You will hear privileged discussions, damning indictments, and stark revelations. Once known collectively only to the agents intercepting them, these files have acquired the distinct identifier, disrespect. Disrespect welcomes Laura Katari and Peter Hutton from the Hamilton Poverty Roundtable. We're going to talk about the future of ODSP benefits, the review that's underway, and the political situation, how it affects those factors. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Glad to be back with you, Jeff.
So there's nothing on the agenda outside what the commission announces. It's a real set aside.
We're told there are little things that are more the bureaucrats' idea of change in the face of that ratcheting up pressure around adequacy of rates and so forth. The commission basically allowed the government to sidestep that for 3 years.
Three? Oh, yeah, meaning since this is the final year, yeah.
Since this process started.
Yeah.
Because the commission was given a mandate based on a sort of high-profile group of people the province put together that sort of to give them advice about what they should do.
Yeah.
How do, you know, this eminent panel, tell us how we should go ahead in implementing our promise to review social assistance.
Yeah.
That was almost a year.
Yeah.
And then the commission, another 18 months.
And then that runs past the budget date.
All that they have done has been what they had been doing, which was inflationary increases in rates.
All right.
Now, the appointment of the two ministers, both for community and social services, children and youth, to me gives me just a little more hope.
We definitely have a better community services minister, which is good news for people on
who's that?
John Malloy?
Has replaced Madeline Meyer?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, that's good news.
And
Mayor, get this, was side-booted to running the prisons.
That's a more suitable portfolio, I think.
I think it is, too. Yeah. I think it's actually a bit of poetic justice that she'll be doing community safety for the same neighborhood she's left to deteriorate.
Well, I know the
listeners
will be
years.
Glad to hear that. Yeah.
Yeah. No, she's gone.
And both of those ministers.
And Malloy, it was always part of going, even before he went into cabinet, he was on, he was one of the original people on the cabinet's poverty reduction strategy.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Well, both he and Dr. Eric Hoskins. So both of them. Yeah. We're working on it, and now both of them have cabinets. So,
and what's Hoskins have?
Children and youth.
Children and youth.
Okay. Oh, good.
McGinty just announced this in a news release and said these four people, and then went off on vacation and said, and basically sort of said, well, if you don't like it, Tories and NDP, well, that's tough.
Yeah. Yeah.
Things that don't necessarily involve an additional governmental expenditure, such as rule and regulation changes or simplification of the rules.
I think reducing the number of rules, that's something they came to the table with as soon as they came out.
Oh.
Actually stating that 800 rules were ridiculous, untenable, and there was no way that they could be applied equally. Okay. By caseworkers across the board.
Right, because you have to know the 800 rules.
You have to know it, you have to understand it, and everyone has to understand it the same way. And there's no way you're going to do that 800 times with every worker.
We can speculate that the three things are going to happen with the commission. That's one. to the commission, probably because of the pressures around the province, is going to not necessarily adjust rates, but that they're probably in the short term recommend some additional special transitional benefit.
Okay.
Whether that's going to be on housing or food, up in the air, how much, probably not a lot, but something.
From the sound of the NDP, it might be housing.
That's what the NDP put in their platform, right? The pressure up until the last little while on the government had been the $100 food in the budget thing was the one that they thought that those with connected to the Liberal Party in some form or fashion thought was something that they could sell to the government. And that's why it sort of came to the top of the heap. If you look at sort of the talk that Minister Sheikh gave on campus to the Economic Society here just a week ago.
I was there for that,
I think some sort of recommendation from the commission about further study or moving towards some kind of rates board, some sort of
accountable body
or process to take some of the arbitrariness out of the setting of rates. Probably is something that both the commissioners at this point certainly believe in, and while I don't think that the political pressure is on them that it's going to be probably some kind of recommendation to look at this when we can kind of deal, and some sort of small financial thing as a short term step, all rationalized around the bad economic times argument. And then the third piece is what the government really wanted, has always traditionally wanted. It's been a strong suit of this, of the Liberal government, which is doing things that appear to change the system to encourage people to go out and seek work. Whether that's further changes in the rules around how much income people can keep on a part-time basis or around sports, something along that line.
They could set up the AODA tribunal they promised a few years ago. Be nice if you get quit. If you started a night course or you started a job and you met discrimination, you could get quick action on it.
That's probably one of the areas that we need to, we as community here, I don't think have done a good enough job yet of coming up with tangible asks that they can recommend that might actually be doable. I don't know that something like that is necessarily on the commission's radar right now, but we need to be thinking about and need advice from people through the roundtables working group about some of those kinds of things that, we can't think of everything. And I certainly had not sort of made that connection, that's the kind of thing that minimal redeployment of resources the government could possibly do. The difficulty always will be is the government's going to likely to want to do some of these kinds of things, which is going to pass the cost of actually doing something about it down the chain.
What do you think, Laura?
Not necessarily they have to spend it, but
I was actually thinking of advocacy the other day. I was speaking to another ODSP recipient, and actually having some sort of group as part of training and employment supports to go out and actually speak to employers about how employable people actually are when they go to apply for a job. People are being shut down as soon as they are seen at jobs.
Yeah.
If they have some sort of visible disability, people don't want to do all the reforms. And I think it's a lot easier to accommodate people than what employers may think. And I think a lot more work has to be done out in the labor force. In that manner. And I know that also falls under community and social services, the new Access Ontario, which really has no teeth.
It's sort of counterpart to the AODA, right? I mean, that everybody has to come up with a plan and everybody has to make steps to implement it, and nobody pays anything if they don't.
Exactly. Yeah. There's, you know, so you have a plan. I have a plan. I will bring something outdoors to you if you'd like to purchase it. That really doesn't change circumstances much beyond what I'm doing right now when I can't get into a store. So it's, I think, something very directed towards sitting down with a newspaper and someone with a disability going, I want to apply for that job.
Yeah.
And I want to make sure that I'm not shut down before they even see my resume.
Well, you can get shut down in attempting to retrain for a job, too. Yeah, it's tough.
It is.
Yeah. You know, it's all well and good to train, or but if you don't change the mindset of the employers out there, well, then nothing's going to happen. And people, given the choice of two or three, different people, one's got this it's going to cause this this set of accommodation issues. These two aren't. Well, I'm going to come up with a reason to say that one of these two is the most qualified for the job.
Yeah.
I forget how she. I'm trying to think of how.
I think the pending employment crisis is the key to that. When employers actually realize that not only are they going to be short of applicants, but they begin to become short of applicants, and maybe some buzz around that. That it's coming, and the smart employers will get the pick of the applicants when they realize that they can solve the shortage this way. Who was it hired all but all Aboriginals? Was it in Alberta, wasn't it? One of the oil companies said they love Aboriginal workers, And and they met their they found the oil field workers hard to come by, but when they tapped the Aboriginal community, they weren't hard to come by at all. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I grew up believing, this cottage industry, and everyone was going to work from home and, lesser work hours per week. And here I am with disability needing to work less hours per week, would love to be able to work from home. So the energy expended actually getting ready and going out to a job I don't need to do, and I could focus on just working at my computer. And then you can't find employers that are actually willing to do that. So, 20 years ago, I was told this is the future, and now I'm ill and I need this. And
where's
I
your
can't
flying
find
car?
It. Yeah, I can't find
future,
it anywhere.
The employment crisis, well, in some occupations, the employment crisis is already here.
Mm-hmm.
And
which
our society is in massive denial. We are already in employment crisis in most of the skilled trades.
Yes.
Made
we're
all
in a training crisis
because,
too.
Because all what did we spend all our stimulus money on? Well, we spent it on construction. It required a lot of purchase of skilled labor and value added materials.
Mm-hmm.
Now they are aware that the apprenticeship programs have been difficult to access, and I believe they. I know through the roundtable work, they are actually working to make it more accessible and an easier process to find and sign up for. And I believe even the Liberal government knows that. So that is in the works because they know they need skilled trades. They need these apprenticeships starting. Some of the apprenticeships have dried up because they haven't had people going through the program. So,
And our the popular perception that the university degree is your ticket to some great wonderful job, but rapidly we're turning into your 4-year honors university degree is your ticket to being a cashier or a server at Tim Hortons. In the bizarre the ill matching of our training with our actual employment needs.
Do we see a change in that coming with the changes recommended for ODSP, a change in access to training?
I think that that's something that is an achievable change.
But you don't see it on the radar yet?
It's where the government's at.
Okay.
There's no question it's where the government's at. It is the kind of thing that I think that they can present on these issues that is going to get minimal pushback from the other two parties. So,
okay,
legislatively, it's possible to do. Changes in benefit rates. You know, it's going to take pressure from the NDP on the government to make that happen.
All right.
Because they're not going to get, they're not going to be able to carry a consensus
with the conservatives.
With the conservatives.
Laura?
One thing I don't think will be addressed, just from the few words I had with the commissioners while they were here, is the fact that there really are people on ODSP that cannot work.
Right.
And what do you do with those people for 40 years of their lives? Do you leave them in poverty? Do you escalate the amount of health care they need because they're living in poverty and with their illness concurrently? And it's sad, but out of all the things we're looking at, I think that's probably going to be the most neglected.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that these people are accumulating medical liabilities is not going to be addressed by the commission?
We'd like it to be, but
absolutely.
The unsung issues because of popular perceptions about maybe personal responsibility and all sorts of fundamentally, we give less in support to someone who is disabled through no fault of their own than we do the senior citizen. That's going to reflect, as Laura says, in
healthcare.
Much bigger cost issues over the lifetime of that person. Similarly, we give lip service to family values and so forth and so on, yet basically we put on a single mother with a child under the age of 5, or even a child in school, we put the same pressures to find full-time employment on them by paying them at the same rate as a short-term Ontario Works recipient, someone who's out clearly, at least for that portion of their life, is going to be on the system for a number of years. That makes their ability to move forward in their life just all the more difficult. Similarly, the perception that singles on Ontario Works are all basically
slackers,
drug abusers, alcoholics. So therefore, we can safely write them off and again pay a level of support that basically does nothing more than create a self-fulfilling prophecy. Nobody, not even the politicians, are willing to admit that when confronted with the numbers, that someone in the city of Hamilton cannot have even the barest of reasonable life situation living on just under $600 a month.
Yeah. You spoke about what you thought the political situation with the minority government might do for the implementation of changes in ODSP. What do you see happening there? And McGuinty's, as Laura remarked, McGuinty's come up with a tough face. I guess he has to because he's in a corner. What can realistically be brought to bear in him with the NDP on the one side and the Conservatives on another? He maintains he can pick from the NDP or the Conservatives according to what he wants to implement. I'm not so sure. Hudak and Horvath are by no means uncommunicative with one another. And if they decide they're being had, I think he may be surprised.
We know what the commission said. What the commissioner said to us in answer to the question, you know, what happens after the provincial election back in July when they were here in town, they were basically saying in private and even said publicly in the platform that, you know, all three parties have agreed changes needed in the system.
Right.
Probably all three parties have different ideas of what the priorities for those changes would be. The minority situation probably isn't going to influence what comes forward. It's going to influence how soon things come forward.
All right.
But the basic sort of thrust of where the McGuinty government wants to go on these issues probably is the agenda that we're looking at, that neither of the other two parties are going to be able to change that substantially.
Well, unless they agree on something and are ready to fork over enough for an election.
still very tough sledding to get any of these issues into the last provincial election. It's not top of mind on a lot of the members of the caucuses of the two parties. Use the example when the roundtable did their challenge during the campaign, asking each of the candidates to tweet their supporters on Twitter that they supported reform of social assistance. Well, we had all four NDP candidates in this area do that. We had all four Liberal candidates do that. All four Conservative candidates ignored it.
Oh, okay.
No response.
Oh, okay.
We included, I think I'm right in saying probably Tim Hudak would have been included in that.
Okay.
So these issues are not a priority for the Conservative Party by and large. And those caucus members or people in the Conservative Party who might have had some inkling to be interested in those issues, by and large, did not win. By and large, the Conservative caucus is probably most of the people on there are, at least initially, are going to be looking at agenda issues that are much different than anything that we're talking about here.
Laura?
I think, though, for the Conservatives, just out of their own change book, they are very much behind training and getting people to work and keeping more of their money that they earn for longer to ease the transition. And that was in change book. I don't know if we can hold them to that
and
if they came
they
to a vote right now.
Conservatives are going to have, I think, much more of an influence on the government's agenda than the NDP is going to. And so, yeah, you look at the areas of convergence between the two, and Laura's absolutely bang on. Action on that score is the one that most likely to happen, and it's the one we probably have to think long and hard about how we shape that to people's best advantage.
How do we reconcile that with the Liberal initiative to mainline employment training? You know, eliminate dedicated agencies for disabled people and to try and stream them into agencies that train able people.
Well, obviously that I would say that's something that we need to fight.
Yeah. Laura?
Because it's not going to work.
Yeah.
And it's a blatant attempt to basically cut budgets.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm thinking of. It's in order to meet Drummond's, you know, cut the fat out of programs, save money. Now, to be quite honest, the amount we are spending on healthcare, it was the Registered Nurses Association of Ontario. They came out with $32 to $38 billion in poverty-related healthcare costs, both public and private.
Really?
So lost to industry as well. I believe it was the National Council of Welfare that also came up with astronomical costs, healthcare costs of poverty as well. We're spending $6.6 million on social assistance.
Oh, jeez.
So when you're looking at four times the related cost and you want to save costs, you know, you're getting the Drummond Report, I think it is an opportunity for us to step forward and keep pushing that issue.
But the priorities are reversed.
Absolutely. You're causing more damage keeping the system the way it is than actually assisting any of your budget.
It's where the money probably, I mean, that's just the healthcare numbers. That's not getting into
training,
the additional
discrimination.
The additional costs that you go talk to our two directors of education here and what the extra costs in their budget that they know of that they're spending. Poverty-related issues because of income distribution issues just in this community or the whole justice issue
and just a set
of issues and the big debate that's going on primarily in Ottawa right now but has major impacts on the province in terms of how we deal with criminal justice issues and whether it's a restorative justice kind of thing or a punishment kind of thing.
I get the feeling both of you are viewing tough on crime as really tough on poverty.
Largely.
Yeah.
I would maybe hasten to say that's not the intent.
Oh no!
But it's the result, because the ramifications are not being thought through.
Mm-hmm.
We see it even what's going on with police budgets, municipalities, how we've allowed this situation. Police budgets are basically crowding out, and the ever-escalating money that's being thrown into police budgets is crowding out other services now.
Yeah, that's true.
And the rubber's going to hit the road. We just can't, in the face of declining crime statistics, in the face of declining violent crime statistics, I can argue about whether stuff is being reported or not, but in the face of it, the outward evidence, we can't keep doing some of the things in society that we're doing, which are based on our perception of what is the reality on the ground. Better services to help people
cope
with their day-to-day living issues will continue that spiral down of those kinds of costs if we adapt. Continue to adopt the barricade kind of mentality. Terry Cook, the current chair of the Hamilton Community Foundation, or CEO, excuse me, former politician, I mean, talks about, you know, we're rapidly moving down the road of, you can be all right, Jack, out in your nice little suburb in Carlisle, but you're paying for the cost of every of all of these, the maldistribution of income, the economic difficulties, the environmental difficulties, the social difficulties in down the center city. Well, you're paying for them.
Yeah, that's true. Laura?
I also want to point out that mandatory minimum sentences without judges' discretion is putting people into a system that is taking away from any work or job experience and creating a larger poverty market in the end. I remember a quote I once heard saying, what good are resume job finding clubs and resume writing assistants when all I'm going to write down is jail time, jail time, jail time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And we have so little in the way of supports for those folks. Agencies like John Howard and EFRI and the Bridge here in this community are being cut, struggling along to provide, again, that outlet to redirect people. And it's becoming, I mean, it's been talked about even on national radio programs these days about this concept that you can send someone to jail for, you know, unless you decide that what you're going to do is, you know, send all these people to jail for the rest of their lives for stealing
a
loaf of bread.
Yeah.
To use that, you know, historic analogy, you can put people in prison and they're going to be there and they're going to come out. And if you don't do something with them to help them go in a different direction once they come out, well, what are you, you know, what have you accomplished?
You spent $70,000 each one, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, and more and more of them. Well, is that light at the end of the tunnel a train, or is there some optimism for the outcome of a juncture between social supports, social ODSP benefits in particular, workfare benefits, and a better start for people trying to climb back into the system, trying to get there, trying to be responsible, trying to be self-supporting, trying to live up to their own needs for self-esteem?
I don't think it's a train necessarily coming at us. But, you know, maybe one could argue that things can't get much worse than what they are now because they're pretty bad.
Oh, an optimist would argue that that's proof enough that things are going to get better. Laura?
I tend to believe that I'm not sure how fast things will get better, but I think the awareness even amongst the old school small C conservatives that have been coming out of the closet and saying, hey, there's a problem here and you have to deal with it. And it's not going to go away by just telling people to get a job. You know, when Senator Hugh Segal comes out and starts talking about guaranteed minimum incomes, you know there's a big change in attitude and that there's a serious problem that needs to be addressed. So it's getting out there. It's probably not as fast as what most of us wish, but I think it is happening.
So final comment, you get to make a final comment. I'm curious as to whether the commission reviewing social assistance rules and rates is going to tie into this need for change.
Yes. I don't know how I hope that they go as far as we would like them to do. There's no guarantees. And that's our challenge for the next little while is, as I said earlier, is we're going to, as the working group of the roundtable, we're going to be spending time looking at some more specific ideas. We've identified through our public consultations here five general areas that we think change is needed in. They basically cover the entire gamut of our social assistance framework. Laura's going to have to help me with this, but generally came out of that we need to do something around supports, particularly employment supports, but other supports, things like transportation. Definitely need to develop some kind of system to address the adequacy of rates and keep them adequate compared to the actual costs of living out there. There was one, education is a general area. In terms of, again, providing supports from an early age, which, is an area I think that, probably this government's certainly doing better at than any other. But that also involves the training aspects of things.
So those are three, right?
Yeah.
You want to briefly name them again?
Well, it's the general area of training, the general area of employment and other supports like transportation that get you to the job, the adequacy of rates, and there are two others, but I can't remember.
Yes, affordable housing and communication. And I know we discussed the use of online applications.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think that falls under better communication. I think they will have to do a lot better than an online application to smooth the problems people have been having, either through first language issues or even mental health, developmental disabilities, having people trained to actually deal with the people that they're serving in order to facilitate an easier process or a healthier, happier process is really important.
Yeah. So that's where we're going. The commission will come out with recommendations. We're told possibly what's being called an options report as early as a month from now.
Oh, okay.
And those will be out there for public comment.
Okay.
But we're also going to continue, going to continue to hammer in on what we think needs to be done, and of course hammer in if those options don't cut it, we're going to be trying to encourage people to voice their opinion and say
good.
So.
Well, thanks for your time here today.
Just past the midpoint of the show, Smokin', Joe Kubek and Benoit King. My heart's in Texas.
I like to visit California, it's the Golden State. Lots of pretty girls on that road to ski. But my heart's in Texas. Can't stay away too long. Got to get right back. Yeah, baby, that's my home. Now when I'm in New York, I'm in a different room.
story. I seen Big Ben in all his glory, but my heart's in Texas. He's still way too long. I got to get right back. Yeah, baby, that's my home. You know my heart's in Texas. Can't stay away too long. Yeah, my heart's in Texas. Can't stay away too long. I got to get right back. Yeah, baby, that's my home.
Now Disrespect brings you a retrospective, Dr. Tim Smith, and the relationship between gender and heart disease.
Disrespect welcomes to the show Tim Smith from the University of Utah, a psychology professor who's done a study by gender of stress and heart disease. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Your study takes an unusual slant on this. What slant does it take, and what motivated you to do the study this way?
Well, we were interested in following up some research that had previously demonstrated that couples' reports of marital stress or a history of separation and divorce was a risk factor for heart disease. We wanted to see if we could replicate or demonstrate that relationship again by looking at how the couple actually talks to each other.
So were these your studies that had drawn these indications before, or were they other doctors' studies?
There were other researchers in the field.
Right.
In this country and others.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you constructed a very specific study.
Yeah, we wanted to see whether just rather than couples' kind of complaints, whether or not you could see this actually in their behavior. And sure enough, conversational styles during these disagreements were related to an early stage of the disease, atherosclerosis, before kind of clinically apparent coronary disease.
So for a listener, can you tell us how you measured these results?
Yeah.
In lay terms.
To start with the outcome, atherosclerosis, to keep people from having to go through some sort of invasive or potentially dangerous medical test, we used an increasingly common form of X-ray, a CT scan that picks up calcium deposits in the coronary arteries. Calcium is a component of sort of the middle or later stages of atherosclerosis. It's the so-called hardening of the arteries. The newer technology can actually take a picture of this that's no more dangerous than a regular X-ray. So we could bring couples who are outwardly healthy in and do this.
So calcium is a constituent part of atherosclerotic plaque, and you use this to identify the growth of plaque.
Yes.
Ah.
And now on the other end of it, what we did was bring couples in and give them sort of a top 10 list of the things that couples often disagree about: money, in-laws, kids, vacations, household duties. And for each couple, we picked the topic that they agreed that they mostly disagree about this, and then asked them to talk about it in front of the video cameras. And we used a coding system that's developed by my colleagues here at the University of Utah that measures fairly precisely two dimensions of this conversation: the level of warmth and friendliness versus coldness and hostility, sort of nice versus mean, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other dimension is how much control or dominance is expressed in their comments, from very controlling and heavy-handed down to sort of deferential or even submissive.
So that's an interesting grid that you set up there. So there is, theoretically, there's four conditions that you measured. Is nice controlling, mean controlling, a nice dominant, and mean dominant?
Yeah, right. All blends. Those describe what's called the interpersonal circumplex, which is a long-standing dimensional model of how social behavior is structured. That,
okay.
All of the things we say to each other vary along those two dimensions.
And you must have picked some unusually good-natured couples that can, you know, consent to this kind of a study.
Well, it's interesting. These couples needed to be old enough to have atherosclerosis, or at least many of them, and so they were in their early 60s,
but
outwardly healthy. Nobody had had a prior diagnosis of cardiovascular disease. That would have
you required them to have atherosclerosis so that you could measure the growth of it?
We took everybody who was willing to do this who was free of cardiovascular disease. So there were people in the sample who did not have any atherosclerosis, and then people who had lots of it.
So they didn't have to be old enough so that they had it at the start of the test. They had to be old enough that they could manifest it.
Correct. They had to be old enough that it was not rare in the population.
Right. Okay.
And they had been married on average about 25 years or so. These are relatively normal, seemingly happy and well-adjusted 60-year-olds, with the exception that they might be a little healthier outwardly than many 60-year-olds.
Okay. So where did you proceed from there?
So we sort of looked at this literature and took from it sort of a gendered hypothesis, if you will. There's literature to suggest that men and women pay attention to different aspects of their interpersonal worlds, their relationships, and are bothered by different things in their relationships.
Right.
Now, there's similarities and differences between men and women, and probably just as many differences among men as between men and women and all of that. So this is something of a generality, but tends to be true on average, that women pay more attention to that warmth dimension, friendliness versus hostility, and are more bothered by it in terms of the things that they describe as stressful. And men pay more attention to the control or dominance dimension and are more bothered by difficulties there. And so we basically went in to test this prediction that while marital strain, if you will, would be unhealthy for both men and women, the specific behavioral manifestations that might be unhealthy could differ for men and women, and that's indeed what we found.
Yeah, and since you expected to find it, you probably weren't surprised, but the rest of the world seemed surprised when the news broke.
Yeah, I think two things were surprising. One is that you could find something about this, you know, very slow-growing, progressive, but up until this point in their lives, silent disease on the basis of a conversation like that, because they happen every day.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that was surprising. And then finding that the gender difference in what might be most important about those marital interactions, I think also was very interesting to people.
So if you're a man and you want to choose a partner for a healthy relationship, the criteria are a little different than if you're a woman and you want to choose a partner for a relationship that will help you stay healthy, aren't they?
Well, it's an interesting issue. You know, this idea, how much of this is choosing the partner versus a potentially modifiable just kind of habit of the way we talk to each other.
Yeah.
We had good measures of personality as well as these behavioral measures, and it is the case that those same two dimensions, how controlling people are and how unfriendly they are, when you measure them as personality characteristics, what are they like in general, those too were related to atherosclerosis. But these conversational habits, if you will, in the way the couple talks to each other, were sort of an independent predictor. In other words, the statistical associations were separate from those involving personality.
Can you elaborate on that? Because it's a little bit of a headbender for
you. Yeah, it is. I guess the idea is that this relationship, obviously very important, it's the central relationship in these people's lives by and large, is not, how they talk to each other is not just a manifestation of their personality, that it, in a way, has a character all its own.
Oh.
And what that character of that relationship is like is probably related to how much sort of chronic stress versus soothing is available in it, and that's not surprisingly related to their heart risk.
Okay. Now, again, the difference for men and for women, chronic stress comes from different causes for the men and the women.
Yeah, specifically what we found is that when we're talking about women's heart health, how friendly versus hostile they were, the women themselves,
right,
an important predictor, such that women who were less friendly and more hostile had more atherosclerosis, and
right,
that was especially true if their husband was also someone who made lots of hostile remarks during this disagreement.
Oh, I see.
Whereas for husbands, their own hostility and their wives' hostility in those remarks
of the women, was it who initiated that caused the atherosclerosis, or was it simply a sort of presence created by the two of them, regardless where it started and where it ended?
The latter, or just this is the way that they talked to each other.
So she was hostile, or he was hostile, or they were both hostile. She was more at risk. And for the men, if he was controlling, or she was controlling, or they were both controlling, he was more at risk.
Exactly.
I see. So we're looking for a friendly relationship where no one goes overboard, try to be controlling.
Right. If there are implications, the idea is to, I mean, I don't think there are ways to avoid disagreements being married for 25 years. It's just sort of part and parcel of the,
sure.
of the arrangement. But the question is, are there ways to talk to each other that don't engender chronic stress? And I think those would be disagreements where you can still remain warm and maybe address them without sort of the heavy-handed controlling.
So this is a natural gift or an acquired gift, either one, but worth having from the sound of it.
Yes.
All right. So did your study lead you to make any further conclusions? Are you going to carry on with the study into further studies of this behavioral discovery?
Yeah, we're doing a couple of different things. One, we want to bring everybody back and see if we can predict the progression of the disease, not just its current severity. It's a little stronger, more compelling scientific test of the hypothesis. And then we have the same sort of behavioral measures on couples who are younger, in their 40s, and we want to bring them back and measure earlier symptoms of atherosclerosis. Those folks don't have much calcification because it tends to occur a little later.
Right.
So we would bring them back and look at other signs of the early stages of the disease. And again, things we can do that aren't invasive. That would be ultrasound studies of the atherosclerosis in their carotid arteries, the arteries that bring blood to the head. So the carotid arteries, you can measure thickening of those artery walls, and that's not only associated with increased risk of stroke, but it's also associated with increased risk of atherosclerosis in the coronary arteries. If you have them in that site, you're likely to have them in the other.
So you're not just measuring calcium now, you're measuring anything that thickens the artery wall.
Right, exactly.
And that's in the younger patients?
That we would do that in everybody, but that would give us a chance to look at it in the younger couples, too.
Right.
And then we're also interested in trying to nail down what the mechanism is, what the psychobiological connection is between talking this way and atherosclerosis. We know a lot of things about what it's not. It's not the fact that people who have these conversational habits are heavier or more sedentary or have high cholesterol.
So you ruled all these things out at the start.
You ruled all these things out. But what we would like to do is look at some biological markers of chronic stress to see if, say, for example, chronic inflammatory conditions or things like that could be part of how you turn the corner, if you will, from a habit of the mind to the changes in the heart.
Well, you would have ruled out chronic inflammatory conditions too, would you not?
We didn't measure things. There's a couple of different ways that's done now, like a thing called C-reactive protein
yep.
your internist might measure these days if you go in for a checkup. There is some literature to suggest that chronic stress elevates that, and of course, chronic inflammation is part of the atherosclerosis, atherosclerotic process, and so that's one of the potential mechanisms. We know that people didn't have, like, chronic inflammatory diseases, but
right.
this would be sort of a lower than illness threshold kind of elevation.
So you did a C-reactive protein blood test, or perhaps a sensitive C-reactive protein blood test, or you're going to do that on
right.
these,
we have,
in
we
these new
lots
studies.
Of, we have lots of samples stored, running out of money to thaw them and analyze them. So.
Good. When you released this study, you probably didn't expect the press that it got. Somebody picked up on it, and it hit all the papers. Were there any elaborations of the test, popular elaborations of the test, that either struck you as germane or as way off the mark?
It's funny. You get a lot of different things. Everything from very thoughtful conversations like the one we're having to things that I think are intended to be a little splashy or whatever. I've had people suggest that so what this is all about is that women are too controlling or something like that. That's not what I'd like to say about this.
So you've got the full spectrum.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, okay. Well, it's interesting for couples who are health conscious. This boomer initiative, boomers who pay attention to their lifespan, and they take supplements for that reason, and they exercise for that reason. And I doubt that many of them have considered seriously modifying their behavior, other than their doctor's admonition to quote unquote avoid stress, which strikes me as kind of futile if you haven't defined it. It's interesting that you have defined it this way.
And it's also the case that even though stress at home is very common, a lot of people in reaction to the doctor's advice like that think about their jobs or money matters or the hassle of commuting in a crowded place or something like that.
And,
our data and some other work suggests that we should not neglect things closer to home.
Yeah, that in fact this is almost a foundation for measuring those other things, and that if you cut this down, everything else would probably, I mean, you haven't established that experimentally, but it seems to make common sense that if this kind of stress is addressed, then all the other stresses matter a little less because they're not loaded on top.
Yeah, I think that's true. I would agree with that close relationships, when they're going well, buffer us, in fact, against the adverse effects of lots of other sources of stress.
That's interesting, almost compensatory.
Yeah, right. So, or another way to think about it, when it's going badly at home, it's this sort of double whammy where you lose the protection against other sources of stress, and there's another one that could be problematic.
But what you're suggesting is that there's almost room for another study on how healthy relationships provide some resilience against stress. You know, in other words, you're not always starting from zero. You can start from below zero if you have support at home.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah, and of course, that's probably another study. It's been nice talking to you, and I value the insights that you've given us. Was there anything that you wanted to say in particular about the study, about the results, about the future that this gives us?
Well, a couple of quick things. One is, I think it's always important to put in perspective if people are ultimately interested in their heart health, they need to pay attention to all of the risk factors. This is interesting and novel, but quite frankly, if you were very sedentary or a smoker and you also experience stress in your life, home or elsewhere, you shouldn't only focus on the stress. Those other behavioral changes are very important as well. So I always want to make sure people put it in context of the rest of the risk factors.
Right.
And then the other thing is just to encourage people not to wait until the stress at home gets very pointed. It's possible to change it. There are lots of data to suggest that even quite dysfunctional relationships can be improved with the help of very skilled counselors and therapists. But like a lot of preventive health behaviors, early in relationships or identifying habits that are maybe not quite feeling right, doing something about it sooner rather than later is always a good idea.
Because this progresses over time, and the effects of atherosclerosis are also additive, as you know, like the effects of stress that create it. And the sooner you get at it, the sooner you stop the process or slow the process down. Well, I appreciate that again.
Okay.
Thanks, Tim, and we'll look forward to the results of the coming studies.
Very welcome, and thank you for your interest in our work.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Disrespect, talk with Dr. Tim Smith about heart disease as a measure of how men and women respond differently to emotions in relationships. We end this week's show with a cut from Lyle Lovett about relationships, The Road to Ensenada.
As I lay sick and broken, Viva Mexico. My eyes just won't stay open, and I dream a dream of home. I dream a dream of home, where there's coffee on the table and kindness in your hand. Honey, I'll help you when I'm able, but right now I'm feeling bad. Right now I'm feeling bad. Well, listen to your heart that beats and follow it with both your feet. And as you walk, as you breathe, you ain't no friend to me. You ain't no friend to me. The road to Ensenada is plenty wide and fast. If you head south from Tijuana, then I'll see you at last. Well, I'll see you at last. My eyes, they open slowly and look around the room. The old man, he seems worried, and there ain't no sign of you. There ain't no sign of you. Listen to your heart that beats and follow it with both your feet. And as you walk, as you breathe, you ain't no friend to me. You ain't no friend to me. You can offer to the righteous all the good that you have won, but down here among the unclean, all your good just comes undone. Your good just comes undone.
To me.